Парус нефти. Игорь Сечин возглавил рейтинг.
Эти годы Сечин занимал самые разные позиции.
Как же иначе? Все силовики имеют на это право.
Российского президента Сергей Иванов поддержал тезку,
сейчас
который...
Сейчас Николай Патрушев в городской филармонии прибыл со стороны.
Владимир Якунин доложил президенту за последний год...
Сейчас Владимир Иванович Якунин нам расскажет, как он будет развивать эту ветку.
For more than a decade, they've been the dominant force in Russian politics, holding key positions in government and business, and wielding outsized influence in Vladimir Putin's inner circle. They push for an autocratic and statist political system at home and a more aggressive policy abroad, and they often got their way. But for most of Putin's rule, Russia's vaunted Siloviki, the security service veterans close to the Kremlin leader, have had to compete for influence with a more moderate and technocratic wing of the elite. But now, with the Ukrainian crisis, the accompanying nationalistic wave, and the intensifying crackdown and dissent, the strongmen of the Kremlin seem to have scored a decisive victory, at least for the moment. Russia's Silovik moment has arrived. How far will it go, and what does it mean? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow is Mark Galeotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hey there, Brian.
And joining us from London, also via Skype, is Kirill Kobrin, co-editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology magazine NZ. Welcome, Kirill.
Hello from Londongrad.
Hello, Londongrad, yeah. Mark, I know you bristle at treating the Siloviki as a monolithic block. So let's lay down some boundaries here, if we could. In my intro, I was using the term to describe the security service alumni in Putin's inner circle who are also hardliners politically. We can talk about the security services more broadly and the Siloviki more broadly as well in this. But for now, for those purposes, I was talking about people like Sergei Ivanov, Igor Sechin, Nikolai Patrushev, Vladimir Yakunin, etc. So what do you think? Have the Siloviki in the collective Putin won decisively?
Well, let me flip it around. We can come to in a minute the divisions and the varieties and the shades and colours of Siloviki. But let me start with the question of have they won? That implies that someone was fighting them, which in some ways, actually, I don't think is the case. But it also implies that somehow they are the ones driving policy. Now, one could say that in a way they have won the battle for Putin's ear and heart, but I think it's more the case that, as it were, the certain logic of Putin's character, the certain logic of the way that sort of the circumstances are, is driving Putin in a direction to which actually he once again reaches down and elevates the Siloviki. I mean, in some ways, one could almost look at what's going on in Ukraine as a metaphor here. That Moscow has been stirring up trouble in eastern Ukraine as a means of trying to put pressure on Kiev to get Kiev to come to the negotiating table and basically capitulate. Now, at the moment, that's not happening for a variety of reasons. And what that means is Putin really has a choice. Does he either fall back and say, OK, this is an adventure that isn't really working and it's now beginning to acquire certain costs, time to regroup, or does he push forward? And by temperament, as well as by political necessity, Putin is pushing forward. He cannot afford not to appear the decisive strongman. Well, so too, I mean, I think in terms of his overall policy. I mean, I think Putin was in a position in which either he needed to really quite dramatically step back, and in some ways almost revive the Medvedev idyll, or he had to push forward. And in some ways, you know, sort of reconstitute this much more authoritarian, but now with a sort of additional dose of Russian nationalism policy. And for that, he needs the Siloviki. So in some ways, they have won because Putin has chosen them.
Mm. Now, we've used all these dichotomies that simplify reality, admittedly, but they're useful heuristic devices. And one of them has been the managers and the shareholders. And the shareholders have largely been Siloviki, and the managers have largely been technocrats, by and large, although there is some crossover there. in the past, there's been this struggle between these wings. Have the managers been put in their place? I mean, basically, you're the managers. We are the shareholders. You do as you say and manage as we tell you. Is that game over?
Yeah, I think they have. And the interesting thing is that, in a way, that Siloviki, in terms of, you know, functional roles, spans across these two. I mean, you know, because we have people like Shoigu at the Ministry of Defense, Kolokoltsev, the Interior Minister, and kind of Lavrov as Foreign Minister, who sort of, you know, straddles that thing, who are very, very clearly, they are technocratic managers. They do what they're told to do, and that's all. Whereas then you have other Siloviki, some of whom are kind of, you know, long since really outgrown their Siloviki roots, like Sechin, who are definitely sort of owners rather than anything else. So, I mean, in some ways, I mean, I would say that we have, and far be it from an academic not to overcomplicate things, four varieties, four flavors of Siloviki. I mean, very briefly, there's the technocratic managerial one, like the Shoigus of this world, and but also the Kolokoltsev, who is after all a career cop, and, you know, therefore has, you know, spent his entire life in uniform.
By definition, a Siloviki, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, but these are not people who are in the inner circle. These are not people who seem to demonstrate a particular passion for the kind of nationalist adventures and fantasies that are now dominating in the Kremlin. You know, they just do their job. So that's kind of camp one. And then sort of within the sort of closer Kremlin circles, I mean, you have the Siloviki, who I think really are in some ways the authoritarians by instinct as well as training. They're in some ways closer to the Homo Sovieticus. And that's people like Sergei Ivanov, Botnikov at the FSB, Viktor Ivanov as well at the Federal Drug Service, Nikolai Petrushev. Exactly. So, you know, those are, as it were, the Homo Sovietici. Then you have the more ideological ones, which I mean, the ideology can vary. I mean, this includes Yakunin, the Orthodox Czechist, who seems to be sort of point man on the cultural wars at the moment. But also my sort of longtime favorite, Rogozin.
Who doesn't have a Silovik background. Who doesn't have a Silovik background, but in spirit he's a Silovik.
He is a wannabe Silovik, I mean, in so many ways. And then you have sort of the last kind, who in some ways I think actually, you know, has the Silovik dimension is really a political pedigree element rather than ideology. I mean, that's Sechin, who really is a Silovik in terms of his connections and his background. But these days, you know, he clearly isn't involved really in the discussions about cultural wars. He never really arises in anything other than talking about hydrocarbons. And this is a man who has now outgrown his Silovik ideology, shall we say. He's now purely a ruthless and rapacious business person, but nonetheless, you know, by instincts and by connections, he is within the Silovik camp. So there's a whole variety of different kinds.
Do you see when I speak of the pure managers, your Dvorkoviches, for example, or Kudrin, for example, who's out of government but still very much in the political picture, are they defeated decisively now?
Again, I think defeat, I mean, in some ways, this is more that, you know, I think from Putin's point of view, he has, a cupboard full of...
Let me rephrase that. They've been put in their place and told that you are managers and you're hired to do a job and just do it.
Yeah, exactly. At the moment, that is their role. It doesn't preclude that if 6 months, 12 months down the line, circumstances change and Putin thinks he needs a change in policy, he just then reaches in and elevates them again. This is the nature of the court.
Kirill, would you agree?
Yes, in some sense, of course, especially when if you look at, for instance, the activity of this so-called Silovik or freakish Silovik Rogozin, the latest failure with the launch of the rocket, which had to bring, you know, some satellite to space, it's a huge blow to him. But it's just, you know, it's just one moment. But speaking seriously, I think the problem with the Russian Siloviks has three levels. First level is, you know, historical and international. You know, generals from army or, you know, security services are always participated in the government. You know, in almost all the countries, including, you know, European countries, you know, say General de Gaulle was Silovik. much, by the way. I think the only country which, you know, avoided this way of political history is Great Britain, where, you know, the last Silavik, who was the prime minister, was Duke of Wellington. But if we speak about some other countries which are much closer from, in historical terms, political, you know, cultural and so on, like Turkey, Egypt, and so on. So generals, they are, you know, always from the beginning of their independence, they are always somewhere near their government.
Yeah, you mentioned Turkey, and this is is a characteristic of deep states, is it not? That you have Silavik in
that's
the state.
That's true. And interesting that we now see the ideological conflict in Turkey and even in Egypt between generals and, public politics, which is, you know, more Islamic and so on. So in Turkey and Egypt, generals, they play, you know, technocrat role.
Mm-hmm.
It's not so in Russia, and that's very interesting. And so here we are going to another level, you know, to the level of, you know, recent history of Russia. Of course, now what we see, it's a triumph of Siloviki in a full swing. Yeah, that's true. But we need to, you know, to remember the perspective of the current situation. What will come next from this situation? Because, of course, generals, they can control some areas of public life, of economy, and so on. They cannot produce. They cannot produce ideas. They cannot produce, projects, and they even cannot produce ideology. They can use all of this.
They need the managers to do these things.
They need the managers, and they need, qualified managers, if you want to
succeed. This is one of the big questions. Are the managers going to get in line and play ball? Or are the managers going to rebel when the first hint that this thing is going south, going sour? It's a big question in my mind right now.
I agree, but I'd like to focus on the qualification of these managers. Of course, Dvorkovich and especially Kudrin, the high qualified managers and so on. But what about others? Who is, for instance, Medinsky? He is, of course, he's a manager, but he is a so poor qualified manager that they cannot succeed even playing such game with this. The part of Russian cultural scene and Russian intelligentsia, which is not opposing Putin himself, but they oppose Medinsky,
mm-hmm.
because he's a very bad minister.
Well, he's a lightning rod. He's a good lightning rod for the regime.
Never irritate those who are supporting you. That is, a political wisdom.
Right.
And I am very dubious about the future of current situation. And I agree with Mark. Of course, Putin has now a choice. Pushing forward or rebrand or regroup.
Seems he's made his choice for the moment.
I'm not sure, because now he just look at the situation of last week. There's no serious activity from his side, especially in Ukraine crisis and so on. I think that they are trying to rethink the situation, because if they can understand something now. Till now, they are. They understood that they went too far.
Well, if I remember my figures correctly, and anybody correct me if I'm wrong on this, but isn't it $64 billion of capital flight from Russia just in the first quarter, which exceeds the entire capital flight of the last year, if I'm not mistaken? The ruble's fallen by 6 or 7%. Growth is near zero. That's from the Russian Economics Ministry. The costs of this are becoming apparent. In a previous podcast, I made cited a quote by Walter Russell Mead comparing this nationalistic wave and this Ukraine adventure to a hit of cocaine. When the cocaine wears off, you need more. Well, cocaine's expensive. Cocaine's expensive. And it's also bad for your health, and it's bad for the health of the body politic here. So I don't know if they're rethinking this. Maybe. I hope you're right, but I have my doubts. And one of the things I wanted to look at is a lot of these Siloviki are involved in business. Igor Sechin, for example, as Mark pointed out. Now, he's the CEO of Rosneft. But guess what? He can't go to the U.S. to meet with his partners anymore. Do you see the Siloviki faction being split, possibly, by the sanctions?
I think what we have to realize is that when we see Siloviki in business, on the whole, they are not in real business. They have businesses that are basically simply offshoots of the state. Simply given the sort of a convenient thing. They are not, for example, in banking. They are not in areas that are sort of deeply embedded within the global economy. I think, you know, there is an issue, but I think this is it. This speaks to the limitations or rather the constrictions. When you depend on Siloviki for your advice, for your insights, you will only be getting a certain dimension. The Siloviki are not involved in global business. They're also, I mean, I think it's worth noting one key point about the Siloviki. None of these people are soldiers.
Hmm.
And we talk about Siloviki, men in uniform or whatever. Well, increasingly, they are just spooks. They're not cops and they're not soldiers. They're not, as it were, people who do a real job. In the real world, they are people of the sort of the virtual shadow world. Mm. And likewise, Siloviki business people tend to be in a virtual business world, too.
Except for people like Sechin, who are like head of a pretty serious oil company.
It is, but it's an oil company that is in so many ways really just exactly. I mean, it's the sort of part of, as it were, the kind of state's oil ministry. It's, I mean, I'm inclined to the way that Gazprom was, you know, was kind of often described as the sort of the ministry of gas,
right, which it once was.
I can't help but thinking that the Rosneft, although it goes through many of the sort of the forms of business, really is driven by the state rather than anything else.
Kirill, what do you think? Do you see the sanctions possibly splitting for economic reasons of Siloviki, or would you agree with Mark that they're not involved in real business and therefore it's not going to really affect them?
Answering the first part of your question, I must say, you know, frankly, I don't know, because I know nothing about the inner circle of, you know.
But intuitively, you follow Russian politics pretty closely.
Speaking rationally, of course, they could. They could, but I don't know the real effect. As for the second part of your question, of course I agree with Mark, because our so-called Siloviki economy is a part of a much larger picture of, Russian post-Soviet state. Almost everything is, you know, fake. It's fake parliament. It has fake parliament.
The fake state, right? Going back to that theme.
Yes, fake police. And fake, in some sense, fake economy. Part of the economy, part of Russian economy, of course, it's real, especially small businesses and, you know, some, you know, larger, even big businesses and so on. But when we speak about such companies like Sechin's and so on, it's not a real market economy. I am not a great admirer of, you know, a neoliberal attitude to market economy and so on. But anyway, in these terms, it's not real. And that's why they can't object the change of the course, which we, you know, was observing for last, you know, several months. Mm. But from the other side, on the other hand, I think maybe they are, you know, a bit disappointed with the outcome of the process. Of course, I don't know what was the idea when they began this Crimean crisis and so on, and what was the perspective which they, you know, dreamed about. But the outcome, look, it's very poor. Putting aside, you know, the so-called patriotic history and so on, hysteria and so on in Russia, and, you know, the growth of popularity of Putin and so on. But it's not real, because it's real now, just now. It can change, you know, dramatically in several weeks.
Right.
We saw such things, you know, many times in post-Soviet history.
I mean, one of the things that I've been thinking about this along these lines, Mark, I'd like to get your perspective on this as well, is like in a lot of ways the Siloviki have kind of been able to have it both ways until this crisis. They got to reap the benefits of Russia being integrated into the global economy on one hand, and on the other hand, they got to be Siloviki thugs at home. Now is it time to choose? Or can they continue to have it both ways?
really, it's up to us. In a way, the whole point about their ability to do both is because the outside world, which basically means the West, was willing to allow them to do that. Mm-hmm. We were willing to treat them when they came abroad as, you know, whatever their business card said. And we were willing to deplore, but in no way actually sort of do anything meaningful about whatever thuggishness they may do at home. And again, in this respect, I think that actually Ukraine, and I agree entirely with Kirill, I think that they really are going to rue what they did in Ukraine if they're not already doing so. It's one of these sort of, you know, moments which actually requires us to decide, well, you know, okay, how are we willing to respond?
Well, we are, or the city of London, the government of Germany, we meaning the West. Before we move on to the second section, I wanted Mark, you just to talk briefly. You had an interesting post up on your blog about how it's not just the Siloviki's moment; it's the GRU's moment right now. This crisis has been a boon for the main military intelligence directorate. Can you talk a little bit about that, Mark? How is this crisis affecting the rivalry, inter-service rivalries among the different branches of the Siloviki? Now speaking broadly defined, not the political group, but security services in general.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because obviously this is playing out at a time in which actually tensions within the various security agencies have been on the rise. There had been considerable numbers of sort of individual clashes between them that in and of themselves, none of them were that crucial, but they spoke to increasing tensions and the possibility of another sort of Silovik war akin to the one we've seen in the past. But so what happened is therefore sort of Ukraine's come along and it has redrafted. The Foreign Intelligence Service seems to be very, very quiet. Technically speaking, after all, Ukraine is still a foreign country. But nonetheless, you know, the SVR doesn't really seem to have been that heavily involved. On the other hand, military intelligence, which until recently had been pretty much assailed because it hadn't been regarded as having done that well in 2008 with the Georgian War, and there was talk of it being sort of downgraded to a mere ordinary directorate of the General Staff.
Right, where it would no longer report directly to the president, right? That was the
precisely. But I think, you know, what Ukraine has really brought up is this new form of kind of hybrid, covert, overt conflict. I mean, we could actually call it non-linear warfare, if one used the phrase that Surkov used in a short story. I have to throw in a little Surkov reference.
Yeah, no,
keep you happy. without Sky. In that respect, the GRU, with its special forces as well as its intelligence arm, actually is a very capable instrument. So the GRU has done well. But I mean, I think what we have to realize is at the same time, a lot of these conflicts are still being played out. We've seen Viktor Zolotov, who was the head of the Presidential Security Service and a very close client of Putin's and indeed judo sparring partner, who's just been made first deputy interior minister in charge of the interior troops, i.e. the sort of, you know, the front line of security.
Yeah,
we've seen this continuing struggle for the interior ministry's economic crime and anti-corruption division, which is a sort of one of the really key ones because this is how they put pressure on people in this modern world. They don't accuse them of political crimes, they accuse them of economic crimes. The general in charge of it, who was a young high flyer, has now been arrested. And it does very much seem as if the FSB is increasing its authority. So, I mean, I think, we have two separate dynamics. We have a long-term struggle, which actually is basically working in favor of the political police. And again, it fits into this new line of Putin's.
So you're talking the investigative committee, the FSB.
Exactly. All these people who basically are more interested in what the party line is rather than trivial issues of guilt. But then we also have the Ukraine factor, and that's strengthening the sort of those agencies which can be regarded as reliable, effective ways of asserting Russian power abroad.
And so the GRU they've basically revived themselves, but they're not winning any Siloviki struggle right now over the other branches.
No, because I mean the GRU has never been a domestic security agency. I think for it, just simply surviving as the GRU rather than the mere RU
is a victory.
Is absolutely successful, and that's again says one other thing about going back to this point about that there are no soldiers amongst the top Siloviki. Again, the GRU survives, wins or loses, not because it convinces the chief of the general staff that it's useful, not because it convinces the Minister of Defense that it's useful, but because it convinces the Kremlin that it's usual. So again, I mean, you know, if we want to look at, and it's not that I'm in any way suggesting we're going to see military coups in the future or anything like that, but if we want to look at, as it were, what seem to be interestingly disenfranchised elements of the Siloviki, it's actually the soldiers.
That's something interesting to watch. And anybody who's interested in this issue, Mark's blog, In Moscow Shadows, is a virtual treasure trove. I feel the need to say that because I was reading it in preparation for this podcast. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and shift gears and look at why the 1970s are increasingly being looked at as Russia's golden age, something Kirill wrote a very interesting piece on this week. We'll be joined by Merkat Sheripjan, a senior correspondent and analyst with RFRL's Central Newsroom. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow is Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert on Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us from London also via Skype is Kirill Kobudin, co-editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology magazine NZ. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Честь и слава советскому человеку, человеку труда. Он главное бесценное богатство наше.
Не думай о секундах свысока. Наступит время, сам поймешь, наверное.
Где резной полисад? Где же моя темноглазая? Где Волок? Где Волок?
It's all your fault, Kirill. If you hadn't written that article, I would not have asked Tanya to put together that wonderful clip. So Irina Rodinina and Vladislav Tretiak lit the Olympic cauldron in Sochi. Soviet crooner Yosef Kobzon is a State Duma deputy. Soviet film director Stanislav Gavarukin headed Vladimir Putin's election campaign. The 1973 spy series, The 17 Moments of Spring, is in vogue again. It's that 70s show, Moscow style. Kirill, you wrote a fascinating article this week in the Calvert Journal, and you argued that for many, the Brezhnev era is now being looked at as something like a Russian Victorian age. Highly recommended reading for everybody out there, but for the benefit of those who haven't read it, summarize your argument, Kirill, as briefly as you could.
Of course, there is some division between Queen Victoria and Leonid Ilyich Brezhnev. First of all, gender. Secondly, Brezhnev, died, younger than Queen Victoria. She lived longer than Brezhnev, pitifully. Of course, Brezhnev, not Queen Victoria. But speaking seriously,
I thought you were speaking seriously.
I always, wonder the mechanism of this Soviet nostalgia of post-Soviet society from the 1990s till now. And these feelings, they grew, stronger till, the recent hysterical, outburst. And when you try to understand something, you must understand, first of all, the historical reasons of this. And the obvious thing is that post-Soviet people, they consider the period of Brezhnev rule from the very beginning, not from 1964, but from the end of Otepel, and from the invasion to Czechoslovakia from the end of 60s to his death in the beginning of 80s, as a period of, pretty calm, normal, authentic life. The very idea of normality is very important for any nostalgic feelings.
Because... You make this point in your article. You say it's the point where people stop being mobilized. That was interesting.
Yes, but not just this thing. Don't forget that Khrushchev and especially Brezhnev initiated a huge housing program in USSR. And till now, the most of population of post-Soviet Russia lived in the flats and apartments which had been built during Brezhnev era. Mm. Don't forget about this. And I think the very process of privatization of life, of Soviet life, was very important during 1970s. And when we look at the social and cultural process, real processes in the 1970s in the USSR, you will see that the most important, interesting things was that people began to live their own life. They were left alone. In some sense, of course, there was an ideology, there was Communist Party, and so.
But everybody was just going through the motions.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the second thing is that it's absolutely underestimated that in 1970s, Soviet culture or Soviet Soviet Union produced a very powerful, as we see now, pop culture. Yes,
I know.
Yes, we can laugh now, and of course it's quite ridiculous. But anyway, it was much more powerful than everything that had been produced after the fall of USSR.
I'm reminded of a joke I heard when I was living in the former Soviet Union in the 90s. They say who is Leonid Brezhnev, and the answer was a minor political figure in the age of Alla Pugachova.
She's still alive and still active, by the way.
Yes.
So maybe she will be next president. But I think that that was a very important thing, because if you want to produce a real pop culture, not, ideological, 100% ideological pop culture, but pop culture which connect people with each other, which have something in common, everything in common with the everyday feelings of people, and so on. That was Russian pop culture. I'm speaking about highbrow and middlebrow pop culture, not lowbrow. And on this level, that was absolutely powerful. All this, Russian multifilm animations,
right,
yeah. All this, psychological movies by Roman Balayan, whoever, and so on. Even the highest highest level of Soviet culture, Tarkovsky movies, and so on. They are still now. And moreover, it's very interesting that those who are, who were and still are big, in post-Soviet culture, in, cinema, who are they? Alexander Sakurov, who is from the late Soviet culture. This is Alexei German. Who else? So we even in rock music, Boris Grebenshchikov, Makarevich, and all these people, they have roots in the Soviet period. And the second part of my idea is there's this comparison to Victorian period. Victorian period as an image, as a pop cultural image, is very strong. Not just among the population of UK, but it's very powerful among the world. Yeah. And because those who admire this period, they see this period as, in some sense, normal, authentic. It's a normal, authentic for British way of life, of Britishness. When we speak about so-called Britishness, we speak about mostly about the period of Victorian period, especially late Victorian period, and so on. And this is a strange, link between two periods.
No, it's fascinating how it's going from the period of zastoy, the period of stagnation, to the Victorian period in just a couple of decades.
Yes, but it's interesting also that, as a proof of my idea, that in the second part of 1970s and the beginning of the 80s, there was a huge interest in Soviet Union in Victorian period. There were a lot of TV series like Sherlock Holmes, dramatization of Gilbert Keith Chesterton stories, Robert Louis Stevenson, and so on. So some part of Russian intelligence, Soviet intelligence, they considered late Victorian period as their own.
Right. Now, the first time I got a hint of this was back in the 90s, and you probably the film Amerikanka, which was a popular film in the mid 90s, which was set in this period. It was set in a Kazakh village, actually, if I'm not mistaken.
Northern Kazakhstan.
And with us is Mirkat Shirapjan, who also lived through this period. I'd like to add, we got four guys here, all in our late 40s, early 50s. Mark and I lived through the 70s, which have its own particulars in both the United States and Great Britain, respectively. And the two of you lived through it in the Soviet Union. Mirkat, what would you add to what Kirill is saying here?
Well, fully agree with Kirill, and my own life when it was 1970 I was 10, it was 1980 when 70s are over I was 17, I graduated secondary school. When we came to the big city in 66, we were the only family in the whole building of 90 apartments which had a phone and which had a TV set. And when there was Nu Pogodi animation, different kids were coming to our house to watch that. And my father was in a privileged situation because he was a journalist. And he worked for the Communist Party's organ, Satire. He told me later that he chose Satire because the Satire was a little better than any other sphere in Soviet journalism. But what I want to say, Kirill is absolutely right. The popular music became popular because between 66, let's say, and 73, every family has a TV set. And the popular music, like we heard now, Vologda or Samotsveti, and I have to add here that cultural pop music, not only for Russians, every republic has its own Pesnyari, Samotsveti. Dos Mukasan in Kazakhstan was called a Kazakh Samotsveti, which was allowed even to go to the United States in 1976. And Pesnyari and, you know, Chervoni Gitari in Ukraine. And all this was available on TV, and TV sets became more and more available. And 70s is just in 71, my father was one of the first individuals in our city who bought Zhiguli, Kopeyka, the first issue. It was, and you know, the life was getting better.
Yeah, so dare I say, this is the first time when the Soviet people enjoyed some kind of bourgeois prosperity,
exactly,
or something approximating.
Exactly. And we started having, not only in the central part of the Soviet Union, even in the provinces, in remote places, people started having second houses like dachas. And, you know, there are some ways, what we call today mortgage, the system was different. We call it kooperativi, where you can just get 25,000 rubles for like 30 years through kooperative and build your own second house somewhere in a remote place, or in a village, and to have like a summer house there. It was something people started living. And the generation which went through, my granny told me that she had to use the skin of a sheep slaughtered years ago to make soup during war to feed her 8 children. And this generation was living together with the new thing, right. And people were just looking and say, we live like this now? And that's why people remember right. that period as the best.
And this would also, I mean, so we have a lot of different things here. We have the emergence of the pop culture that Kirill pointed out, the feeling that people weren't being mobilized, the beginnings of prosperity. But what you also had was, this is when the Soviet Union became a superpower, when they reached parity, or there's a perception that they reached parity with the West. And so this again begins to all come together as to why this period is looked at so nostalgically. Now, I can't help but be reminded, and Mark, I'd like your thoughts on this, of like during the 1980s in the United States, during the Reagan period, there was this great nostalgia for the 50s. And there's some similarities to this simpler time, but a time when we were powerful and unchallenged. Mark, what would you add to all this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting that we're having this conversation the week after Victory Day.
Yeah.
Because in a way, I mean, at first glance, it almost looks like there are two separate kinds of nostalgia. For one day or one week a year, there is the hearkening back to the Great Patriotic War, a period of extraordinary mobilization and hardship, but nonetheless sort of great and, you know, sort of evident triumph. And then there is the nostalgia for the sort of the era of the shabby compromise, which also actually was the era of, you know, where the state just said, look, you know, we'll just improve your life steadily. You just stay out of politics. You know, you pretend to be communist. We pretend to believe you and everyone's happy. But actually, in a way, I think that the two are united in this fascinating Victorian era analogy. And it's not just, I mean, I think personally, Brezhnev and Victoria, I think they sort of share looks and a sense of humor. But I mean, also, exactly, the Victorian era is not only this kind of archetypal Britishness. You know, when people think of Britain, they think of fog and bowler hats. They don't think of cool Britannia. But also because the Victorian era was an era of triumph. It was an era in which basically Britain ruled large chunks of the world. It has stability. It has, I mean, in fact, it was a period of extraordinary social and economic change, but that's been lost in the mythological notion of Victoriana. Victoriana is about everyone knowing their place, a certain stability, a sort of a comfort of life, but also a triumphant state experience. And I think exactly that's what people are looking back to. And the fascinating thing is that people in some ways, you know, are actively hearkening back to that. And the interesting way in which this is coming into consumer culture. My wife's done some work on the return of Soviet aesthetic in consumer brands. And so you have things like the sort of the Soyuz Apollo cigarette, actually, which had been lost, being brought back, or Rossfrost, who actually sort of recreated a brand of ice cream that they called Sovietsky Standard, Soviet Standard. You know, this idea that somehow at least Soviet was reliable, it's simple, but it's something to which you actively hearken back to in a way that at the time everyone was desperate for anything that was foreign.
Now rewind a little bit though and think back to when the castling happened and when the decision to bring Putin back and all of the material, all the articles in the Russian press about Brezhnev and, oh my God, Putin's going to turn into Brezhnev. And if he serves his two terms, he's going to rule as long as Brezhnev did. And we're going to go back to this awful Brezhnev period. And now it seems like Russian society is saying, hell yeah, let's go there. How do you explain that?
Well, I'll give you my two cents. Though, in a way, I think Kirill and Mirkat will probably give you a better sense. I mean, my view is, look, I mean, two things. One is there is a difference between what the kind of people who write leader articles in newspapers and ordinary, you know, your trolley bus driver from Omsk. But the second thing is, I mean, I think there is a distinct disconnect between the politics of the situation. No one is really thinking back saying, wow, that Brezhnev guy, he knew how to run a country. The very virtue of the Brezhnev system was that it was rubbish, that it wasn't able to and didn't try to run things. Or when it did try to run things, it usually failed. Or you could just simply because you had a friend or because you paid a bribe, you could make, as it were, the state go away. So in a way, I mean, I don't think anyone really necessarily has nostalgia for the upper level cupola of how the political system worked. They have nostalgia for how actually life was lived in that time, and that's very different.
Mirkat, would you agree with that?
I agree with that. I just also have to mention that when the 70s were ending in December, that was the first time when our generation lived through the war, when we were, it was Afghanistan. We were told about Afghanistan officially only in 80. That was the first thing. The second thing is, even during the 70s, people, I understand people's nostalgia, but in 70s, there was Vysotsky, which was semi-banned and not banned. And on one hand, he was on TV and everywhere, but some of his songs were banned. But we all had them, and we are allowed to have them. The other thing is, we also, my father, what is nostalgic about it, like me and my father were listening to Radio Liberty in the night, or what is nostalgic when we were risking to be punished, even go to jail in the Soviet Army, but we're listening to Voice of America using the best Soviet radio stations, military radio stations, which were not possible to jam.
That warms my heart.
Yeah, this is also nostalgia. Also, nostalgia is when we heard about Mustafa Jemilov and Crimean Tatars problems. And also, what is nostalgia talks of my uncle who was feeding Chechens in Uskiminogorsk, and for that he was expelled from his FZU, Fabrichno-Zavodskoye Obuchenie, and he had to hide in remote pastures for several years until 53, and my grandparents changed his identity so that he was not punished, and he came back. And it was 70s. He told me all these stories in 70s. And those 70s also, very many things in 70s. Everything is nostalgia. But I agree with Kirill, and I agree with Mark but this, when he says that there are some rubbish, some things, but that's a life we all had, and... I think, unfortunately, what we are having now with Ukraine is like new Afghanistan. What we have with dissidents like Jemilov again on agenda. It's also 70s, and again today on agenda is such name as Makarevich, Shevchuk,
right,
which can be equal to.
You raised some things here, yeah, that actually get to, and because we're coming close to the end here. You raise a couple things I want to hit on before we go. And Merkat, as you just pointed out, with all this pseudo-bourgeois prosperity you had in the 70s, you had the seeds of dissent. You and your father listening to Radio Free Europe and Voice of America, the Jamilov and all of this, you had the seeds of dissent that later blossomed. What else makes the 70s similar to today? High oil prices. All this stuff was financed by what? High oil prices. And what happened when the high oil prices went down? Well, this Victorian age did turn into the period of Zastoy. And you had what? Life expectancy plummeting, alcoholism rising. Perestroika happened for a reason. It's because Soviet society was literally, and the Soviet economy was literally becoming sick. So on that note... is the 70s nostalgia going to sour as the current period sours, I guess? Last word to everybody before we wrap up.
First of all, of course, it's nostalgic feelings not for real 1970s. It's nostalgic feelings for the image, pop cultural image of this period, which is, fed by, all this quite good and, high quality production of Soviet culture in 1970s, as it turned out. Secondly, the reason of this, all these nostalgic feelings is the failure of so-called post-Soviet project in Russia as an idea of a new brave Russia, which will, be absolutely different from the Soviet Union. That is the real and the most serious thing.
So all they have is World War II in the 70s, yes, as Mark pointed out.
Yes. It's very important because post-Soviet period, all this, 20, nearly almost 20 years, was considered by the society as a sort of in-between period, between something which is, which was good in one opinion and which was bad in other opinion, to some future.
Mm.
And now it finished.
Mm.
And it's very interesting because now we observe birth of the absolutely new situation when those who want to be real politics in next 10 years must set up absolutely new agenda, mm, which is free from nostalgia and which is free of, the legacy of 90s and noughties and so on.
All right, the clock is ticking. We're coming down to the end. Mark Merkat, last words briefly.
Talking about nostalgia, I think the major thing is that for many in Russia, I'm not talking about intelligentsia, but people who are living in remote places in Siberia and elsewhere in provinces, nostalgia is also nostalgia of being a big brother.
Mm.
That's a big role, and that's why Putin's popularity today is over 80%.
Mm. Mark, last word to you.
1970s parallel there. I mean, when the oil prices went down, there were decisions to be made. And the point is that the Soviet leadership didn't decide to reduce their arms spending, didn't decide to reduce the space program and so forth. They precisely cut at the lives of ordinary people, which is what led to the alcoholism, the dissolution and such like. I mean, likewise, the parallel here we have is that there are decisions that are being made in the Kremlin. Nothing is guaranteed, but Putin, like Brezhnev, seems to want to spend on things like the military and on empire. And in due course, the risk is, again, it has the same impact.
Right. All right, on that note, we'll wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I would like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me in the studio here in Prague is Mirhat Sharipjan, a senior correspondent and analyst with RFERL's Central Newsroom. Joining me via Skype from Moscow has been Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. And joining us from London, also via Skype, has been Kirill Kobrin, editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology magazine NZ. Thanks for the enlightening discussion, gentlemen.
My pleasure.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and very overworked producer, Tanya Kancheva, and my totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally awesome Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.